Let us look a little more at this possible chiastic structure. I've already put the basic skeleton on the green board here to favor your side a little bit, because I'm often on this side here, right-handed, I guess. So this is the basic structure of what we may find as a chiasm in the larger macro context of Philippians. Again, I want to emphasize, I'm not presenting that as the final word. It's something that you need to explore, that you need to read Philippians with, and to say, is this borne out? Does it convince thematically and in its structure? Is there something to it? I have already mentioned to you that there's a certain question here on 3, Timothy and Epaphroditus. Why does Paul bring in Timothy and Epaphroditus in the between the exhortation and the warnings, the encouragement towards growth and the warnings to watch out for a certain areas of problem from legalism and antinomianism? What I have not covered here, obviously, is the introduction and a preceding section till 1:26, and also the conclusion for 2 following. So I'm not covering all of Philippians here in this scheme, and but it does relate to the central sections that I have presented here, and I've made it a little more detailed here with the references to the verses, so you can compare the simple outline with the structure here that is presented. What is suggested here is that there is a chiasm between the first section in the main part that speaks about steadfastness. And so I'm just going to put this word here, steadfastness, in suffering, that there's a connection between that steadfastness in suffering and the last section. You see here A and A apostrophe, and that would be man-centered, that there is a connection between the exhortation and the encouragement to grow and to stay in steadfastness on the one hand, and the warning of man-centered antinomianism. You see that these two sections are warnings. These two sections are the encouragements or the admonitions, and here in between you have Timothy and Epaphroditus. And that's the interesting thing, that as Paul presents the encouragement to steadfastness in suffering, that he also gives an example for that with Epaphroditus in 2:25. So Epaphroditus, example for the steadfastness in suffering. And the second exhortation, or the second encouragement, is that of humility. These were the two major points here in the exhortation and encouragement section. A statement and encouragement for the Philippians to grow in humility, and we will certainly look at that a little more in detail. And then an example of Timothy, so that there is a connection between humility and the example of Timothy, and a connection between steadfastness and the example of Epaphroditus. And you have to read that yourself. Just go through it yourself at home and read the section on steadfastness and see whether that's echoed by the example of Epaphroditus and the humility reference and that to Timothy. The first reference to warning is man-centered legalism. These are the warnings, examples, exhortation. This is Christ-centered. This is man-centered. Now, and you see here the connection between humility and man-centeredness, and the connection between suffering, steadfastness and suffering, and man-centered antinomianism. So you have a double chiasm here. You could build it just from the steadfastness to the examples. Or you could say, actually, it's from steadfastness to man-centered antinomianism and humility and man-centered legalism with a smaller chiasm, and that's why I put B1 and A1 as examples given. This is not too complicated of an inversion and a patterning or a mirroring of what is being spoken of in terms of the exhortation, the examples, and the warnings. I find this to be a helpful suggestion in understanding the relationship between the exhortation and the examples, for one, and the relationship between the exhortations and the warnings for another. What are these connections? Well, these connections are relatively simple. You just read the Timothy section 2:19 to 24 and see, does that illustrate more humility or does it illustrate more steadfastness or does it not apply at all? Then you would be back to the drawing board and you would have to say, why does Paul employ the examples of Timothy and Epaphroditus here? I'm quite convinced that that holds true. What is a little more challenging is the relationship between the steadfastness here and man-centered antinomianism on the one hand and humility and man-centered legalism on the other. You see that as Paul encourages the Philippians to hold still as they experience suffering and difficulties, that there is a positive outgrowth from that against a man-centered lawlessness. Let's just read briefly the reference in 1:27-30, what Paul says here. Whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Whatever happens, that already signals with the possibility of suffering. Then whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. Here is a clear indication of suffering. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on Him, but also to suffer for Him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. This is an exhortation not to run out, not to run away from the difficult situation that you may find yourself in. The main emphasis here is external opposition, is criticism from the outside, is oppression from the outside. But I don't think it's only limited to that. I think there's this entire question of what do you do when things get hot? What do you do when things get tough? How do you react when there is a sense of pressure in your life? Paul's exhortation and encouragement is, hold still, not as a martyr, not as a stoic sufferer. Hold still in your trust in Christ. This is an antidote to man-centered antinomianism. You are not going out to please yourself and to seek your own and to pursue your own desires or your own feeling of, I deserve that, I need that, don't come with that, I'm going to get out. Immaturity in terms of children, we can see that more easily, is exactly that. Too much homework? Won't do it. Too much stress? I'll just blank out. Won't do anything. So there's a sense of acting like a donkey. Throw the bag off and run off. That's what we feel like in our natural disposition. So the exhortation to have the eyes of God, to trust in His provision, and to be able to hold still when things get tough, when perhaps God has us in a tight spot and He's working with these laser surgery tools, where we shouldn't move, where we need to hold still, where it is painful, but He is doing His work. the best thing against antinomianism of pleasing yourself. Because see, God wants to draw you, Philippians, into a God-centered life habit. And He uses the tool of suffering to accomplish that. Do not resist suffering in your life. Now, again, I must say with 2 Peter, if you suffer for your own foolishness, don't think that this is a high spiritual attainment that you have. You know, you do what I've just recently heard in the sermon of running up debts with your credit card, and then you really think it's just horrible suffering that you have to pay off alone. Well, suffer for your own foolishness. No, it is when you feel that you should have more room. You should have more recognition. You should have more ease in life, and you find yourself in a tighter spot. There's not much range to move. There's not much range to please yourself. I think you need to wait and get the eyes of God to see that God has you in that place and that there is growth out of that. Growth away from a man-centered pleasing yourself, doing what you please, rather than to be sharpened to a simple dedication and yieldedness to God. So I see that there is this deeper contrast between the acceptance and the willingness to stay in a tight spot. And I'm aware that there are situations that are unbearable. And so I need to be careful in terms of pastoral care that you don't generalize that across the board. But if you feel that God has you in a place, and I think you can assess that yourself, and the question is, between pleasing yourself and staying in the tight spot, I have a hunch that it's right to stay in the tight spot. So I need to be careful here, pastorally careful, because there may be some situation where you really need to get out. I'm thinking of perhaps an abusive marriage situation, and we have had some of those situations in our church in Germany. So I have to be careful. But again, if you feel that the option is please yourself, do what feels good to you, just pursue yourself, but it really does not honor the living God, or stay in that position, in that place of tightness, grow therein, find the Lord to meet you therein, maybe over months, maybe over a long period of time, but there is good coming out of that. So the exhortation of living a life worthy, whatever happens to you, seeking the purposes of God in that situation, I think that is very important, and this contrast to a man-centered lawlessness is very strong. Think about the second point. The way to growth, the way to godliness, is a humility of service, and we're going to look at that in just a minute. A humility beginning at the bottom, not being haughty, not assuming that you are doing great things, but trusting that God will do great things. That you come to the equation in a sense of servitude, in a sense of coming to a relationship, coming to the service in the church with open hands and saying, Lord, you need to help me to relate to this situation properly, to lead properly, to teach properly, to preach properly, to counsel properly. I need you. There's a strong antithesis here to, I've got it together. I know the rules. I'm following them. I've got it made. I don't know about you. You seem to be fishy. You seem to be floundering around. You don't seem to have your act together, but I do. Now you see that a man-centered legalism could be so close to a well-meant desire to be godly, because we are called to be godly. We're called to conform to the laws of God, but not in this way, not in a man-centered way. And so Paul warns the Philippians, perhaps not only against the background of Jewish legalism, Judaizers, but against the background of the Stoic clean-cut guys from the Roman background that have it all together, except they're completely self-centered. To watch out and to actually grow in the attitude of Christ, to be strong in a godly way rather than strong in your own virtue, in your own structure. So I see both with regard to steadfastness in suffering and with regard to humility, this mirror, this contrast. If you want to grow against antinomianism, if you want to grow against pleasing yourself, hold still when God has you in a narrow path. When you want to grow against this man-centered, stoic sense of I've got it together and you should have it together too, really, the antidote, the way forward, is to have your confidence in God rather than in yourself. So I see there's a natural mirroring here in this structure, and that's really all I want to say. And for a small addition, illustrations, examples. I think examples is perhaps the best way to speak about that. Examples that illustrate the humility and the sense of steadfastness in suffering. Let's look a little further here in terms of the flow of thought that I have promised you. We have already done a lot of work, actually, in understanding the flow of thought, but maybe we can draw it now together, taking the simple outline and this kind of a chiastic integration together. There's something happening here in Philippians that I think goes beyond Paul's engagement with Philemon and with the Corinthians. I don't know if you remember, maybe it's too long ago, that I mentioned that Paul is in turbo drive when he throws himself into the equation with Philemon to bridge the gap between Onesimus and Philemon for the sake of the gospel. And that in 2 Corinthians in particular, Paul appeals to the Corinthians that they may have an open heart as he has already had an open heart. I think there's one gear beyond that turbo drive, and I think that's Philippians. And by that I mean that the word partnership is one step beyond Paul giving it all. We see that word used in chapter 1, verse 4, where Paul says this to the Philippians. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel. From the first day, that was back when he traveled through Philippi, until now, being confident of this, that he who has begun, who began a good work in you, will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Partnership. Let me go back to relationships. It is bad if you have a relationship where you kind of look at each other and you say, you come 50%, I come 50%. You move, I move. Paul never does that. In Philemon, Philemon and in 2 Corinthians, we see that Paul is willing to move 80, 90, 95%, whatever is needed to bridge the gap. As Jesus says, you take the first step. Don't wait. Don't point fingers. Don't expect somebody else that may have wronged you to make the first step. You make the first step. You move. So Paul does that. So this bridging of gap is already a significant progress in living out and preaching the gospel of reconciliation. There's one more step forward, and that is partnership. You see, in a relationship in which you agree to team up together against the weaknesses that you identify in each other, to make common enemy and common cause, where you say, I know that's your weakness, and she says, yes, I know that's your weakness, These are our main targets. We're going to work together against these two targets. We're not going to point fingers. We're not going to say, well, you get your act together and then I can maybe follow a little bit too. You take the first step. But rather, we team up. We have a partnership in which we realize that we're up against a major enemy. And we need to pray together. We need to associate together. And we're focusing on these things that separate us, that make us weak, that tear us down, that tempt us to go either into this self-centered legalism or into I'm going to please myself and do what I want, rather than in holding still in the tension in the narrow place that I find myself in, and in having the attitude of servitude, of serving, of bringing an open heart to the situation. Then you have a great opportunity for growth. The only thing is, I've just described some elements of my marriage to you, obviously, if you haven't noticed that yet. The only thing is, natural tendency is to move from partnership into taking sides. That's the natural tendency. If you do not nourish partnership, you will fall back into this I thou. You move first, then I'll move. So I think this is actually a culture of work that Paul is especially furthering with the Philippians to say, we are together. We are facing the opposition together. You are behind me, I am behind you. We are associating together. It's not just that I praise God for the work that He has done in your midst, which we find in other letters. It is not just, it is wonderful to see you testify to God and to have growth. We have moved together and we have made the gospel common cause. That's the most beautiful, the greatest way to approach the struggles that are still there. The dangers, the temptations are still there for the Philippians, but also they can really grow in steadfastness and they can really grow in humility if they approach things in this way. So I think that the encouragement and the exhortation of Paul through Philippians to us in families, in relationships, in friendships, and in the church is to nourish the culture of partnership rather than power struggles. I don't know if you have ever been in a church where there's power struggles. I think there are one or two around. Where people eye each other. Where there is this, I'll give if you give. I'll take if you take. I'll move towards you if you move towards me. You are opposed to each other. You have not realized yet that you cannot waste your energies in that opposition, but you do it anyway. And that you can't win. Because the enemy, the power of the flesh, is so strong that only as you move from that opposition to partnership, and as you realize that it's only because of God's power that you actually can overcome your own sin and that of another person in the church or another person in your friendship, whatever relational level you're in, only then can you come to a place of overcoming. And I find that seriously sad, that in relationships, including myself, I underestimate the enemy that I am fighting against. And I actually fall into the trap of opposition, of defensiveness, of looking to the other person rather than to come into the high ground, onto the high ground of partnership and to say, you know what? We're in this boat together. If we fight on this boat, we're both going to get wet. We're going to capsize. And so many churches, so many relationships are exactly in that kind of a boat or out of the boat, capsized already. So this is the appeal of Paul. And we're certainly going to go a little more deeper here, but on this level in putting the flow of thought together, this is the appeal of Paul. We have found partnership, and as such, I as an imprisoned man for the gospel, and you as people who are being opposed, who experience some strange preachers that take the gospel in their mouth and they have false motives, And you suffer under that. You question that. They oppose you. Also, you who are tempted by a stoic pride and a sense of having it all together, let's partner. Let's join together and see that we have this common enemy. Paul sees it. Paul sees the pattern of sin in his life, Romans 7. Paul sees it in the Philippians. Paul sees the great work that God has begun. He calls them into the nourished culture of partnership to fight together. If we could just develop, if I could develop that culture in my marriage, my family relationships, especially with teenagers, if you can win a battle of partnership so that there's not this I-thou eyeing each other and fighting against each other, rather than to say, you know, we're partners in this. Where would we be? How wonderful the gospel would be able to take hold of our lives and manifest itself. Not that we would be perfect. Partnership does not mean final victory. Partnership means acknowledgement of the struggle and the privilege of being able to associate and to fight together in intercessory prayer, to fight together in seeking the good of the other one. I do not know why we have that principle in our lives, except that I know that we're fallen creatures and that somehow we fall back into a self-defensiveness, into a pattern of fighting our own fight rather than to be vulnerable to the work of God and to turn around and to seek partnership. So I find that the entire purpose of Philippians is partnership in the gospel expressed in this way, exemplified by Timothy and Epaphroditus, outlined in the exhortations and concluded by the warnings, but really focus on that togetherness. And I would like to illustrate that a little bit by looking in some detail at Philippians 1, 3 to 26. And then we're going to take a break and then look at the so-called Philippian hymn in chapter 2. But let's look at the particular section here in chapter 1, 1 to 26 to see a further illustration of this partnership in the gospel, the partnership that God has given them. Philippians 1, 1 to 26 has a very interesting braided structure. Again, looking at the form and how the various verses are addressed, you see that there is a connection, an interconnection between the Philippians and Paul, just to mark by the way he speaks about them and himself that we're in this together. So partnership is not only verbalized, but it is demonstrated, it is illustrated by the literary format that you find here. Just look at that. Verses 3 to 6. Here Paul thanks for the partnership in the gospel, as I have already mentioned. A partnership that began a growth that God will bring to completion. This partnership is illustrated in the next section. Paul, in verses 7 to 8, expresses his joy because what he endures for the sake of the gospel is also the lot of the Philippians. So we have a partnership in the gospel. In 7 to 8, we have a partnership in that which we suffer. All of you share in God's grace with me. So there's this sense of commonality, the sense of bonding together. In verses 9 to 11, Paul prays for the fruit of righteousness which will come from him who began a good work. So here Paul prays for the Philippians. In verses 19 to 26, I know I'm jumping from 9 to 11 to 19 to 26, the Philippians are encouraged to pray for Paul's deliverance. Verse 19, For I know that through your prayers and the help given by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. You see here, Paul prays for them, he encourages them to pray for him, and they certainly do already. And wedged in between verses 9 to 11 and 19 to 26 is the reference to the fact that the gospel advances despite adversity. So I would submit to you that already in the first initial introduction to Philippians and then further expanded here, there's this braidedness between Paul and the Philippians, and that this simply illustrates the partnership in the gospel that is mentioned and announced in chapter 1, verse 4. So, take that with you, that the partnership in the gospel is a calling that Paul reminds the Philippians about, and it is a calling in our lives to take with us from Philippians, that as we indulge in man-centered legalism, as we indulge in our own desires, we thwart, we obstruct, we hinder that growth which Paul is encouraging the Philippians to grow in, to join in. To join in the partnership of the gospel with him in that common bond, and thus together to fight the battle. I don't know about you, but I certainly think that this merits a lot of reflection. Perhaps for you to think about yourself, why you approach things in an oppositional way rather than in a partnership way. We do not have to agree on everything. I think we need to have the courage to say we do not see eye to eye on this point. But we will not divide the partnership over that thing that we cannot agree on. I remember co-laboring with an elder in Germany, and we did not see eye to eye on many points. But we were committed to the partnership of the gospel. And we toughed it out sometimes throughout many hours of conversations and debate. I think that's a wonderful indication and a wonderful challenge that lies before us. And if we can set an example of living out the partnership of the gospel, living out, not just talking about it, but living out that partnership in the gospel, I think there is a wonderful fruit that will grow from that to illustrate that we do not have to be all what is it called? Honey pie and sweet. Everything is fine and dandy. No, I think I mixed up about five different sayings. I know. I pick and choose. Obviously, mostly pick, not choose. No, it doesn't have to be fine and dandy, but it needs to be a sober assessment of what is the battle. And if we underestimate the battle, we will say, "Well, let's fight it in opposition to each other." We see the battle at hand, if we see the challenge and the promise of true growth, we will say, let's not begin this way. Let's team up. And let's identify what is our common enemy. You see the pattern in human nature, don't you? If there is a common enemy, you have unity. If the common enemy is gone, you have disunity. I noticed it in my two boys. They could fight it out quite well, but wait it. If I got in the way, they were like tar, connected, unified against the common object of their father. So, you see, that's a little bit of human nature, even where we can see that, and we just underestimate what is really going on in our lives, in our churches, in our situations, to team up. So, let me leave you with a call to partnership in the gospel. We're going to take a little break and then go to the heart of Paul's encouragement concerning humility. We need to learn a lot on that point, perhaps even more than in the steadfastness in suffering. And so I want to take you back there after a little break, about 5 minutes or so, get some fresh air, and then we'll re-enter. Thank you very much.